My name is Tony Wiggins. I'm with EIM Capital Managers. What's EIM Capital Managers? We're a resources specialist investment house based in Melbourne. We've got an absolute performance based fund called Emerging Producers Company Share Fund, which we'll talk about at the end of the presentation, and absolute fee structure. So I'll hand it to my colleague, John Robertson, who's also on the investment committee of the company. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody, for turning up in such numbers. Despite how rugged the commodity price terrain has been in the past, we've scaled some new peaks in recent times. Commodity price peaks, industry profitability peaks, equity value peaks, and We're in many senses sitting on top of a mountain in terms of those price performances, as well as physically in terms of the resource endowment which we have here in Australia. This chart that's superimposed on our picture of the mountain is a chart of commodity prices, which we're going to spend a little bit of time exploring during the course of this presentation before we then start to look at more particularly at some of the portfolio construction implications of what we're about. I'm not going to go through our paper in a lot of detail. The paper is very much a statistically based analysis. What I will do is just give you some of the key summary conclusions of that paper. In preparing the paper, we were aiming to make some observations about what happens when commodity prices fall. Now, that's not necessarily because we were of a strong view that commodity prices were going to fall, but we thought it's an important aspect of the current market. Because there is sometimes a temptation on the part of people to say, commodity prices are going to fall, quit equities. You know, that's commodity prices are going to rise, buy equities. And we wanted to explore that relationship. Is it reasonable, if we think commodity prices are going to fall, that you just quit equities? And how strong should that commitment be? What are the risks in taking a decision about your equity exposure based on a view about commodity prices? Because what I'm assuming for everybody here is that we are equity investors, not commodity investors. That's another session somewhere else. And I think that's a very important aspect of what we're dealing about here. Now, we've chosen to look at these matters through the perspective of a long period of history. I'm something of an economic historian by background. I believe that the more data we have, the better. The more cycles we're able to analyse, the more robust will be any conclusions about the nature of cycles, how they happen, how they start, how they finish. And until there's some extra evidence that says that's inappropriate, we should continue to default to that history. Now, the methodology that we've adopted is to pull together a lot of data. If we're interested in a long history of cycles, you need at least 10 dozen cycles to make draw any meaningful contribution or conclusions about the data. Now, that implies you need something like 100 years or thereabouts of data. That's not immediately available. So what we've done is we've cobbled together a number of series that will give us some sort of continuous link into the data. Now, I won't go through the statistical analysis that goes with that. Suffice to say that I've drawn on a lot of data that's compiled by the US Bureau of Labor Statistics going back to 1890, as well as the International Monetary Fund, in terms of bringing together a commodity price series that goes back over 100 years. We've done some statistical testing to as part of the decision-making process to choose those, but that's what we're currently using. We've also linking a number of ASX equity price series going back to 1936-37, and then we'll talk a little bit about some of the characteristics of those series, and then we'll do some comparisons. Before going on to do that, just talk a little bit about some of the background research that's relevant in this area. There's one paper by Gorton which explores commodity price returns. That was the principal aim, but also says something about the connection between commodity prices and the prices of the equities of commodity price producers. And that particular paper really emphasises the idea that there is a breakdown in the linkage to some degree, that the equities tend to adopt the characteristics of the markets in which they are trading, and that the correlation between the equities and the commodity prices is less than the correlation in returns between the equities and their home markets. Now, that's an important conclusion in terms of what we're doing. There's also been some work done which looks at the contribution a resource sector equity investment can make to an Australian equity portfolio. And that basically says that if we're looking at it in index format, that the returns that are generated from the resource sector indices are not really sufficiently high to compensate for the greater volatility which comes within that segment. And that's really another way of saying that the resource equities assume the characteristics of the equity market and therefore don't give you the adequate diversification opportunities which you might be looking for in constructing a portfolio. So that's by way of background. We'll come back and touch on some of those issues by way of a conclusion. Before going on, however, we ought to admit to some gross simplifications in what we're saying, because we're going to be talking about commodities, we're going to be talking about equities, but the reality is there's a whole lot going on in the background there by way of specific issues. So even though we're talking about commodities, on the one hand we can have something like nickel prices, which has clearly gone a large part of the way through a cycle and has fallen by over a half, having peaked over a year ago. And then we've got something like iron ore, given the way those prices are set, the way the negotiation process goes, where they're still near the top of their mountain, although given the lags in the process there, there's question about whether they would also follow the same cyclical path in due course. There are also simplifications on the equity price side. On the one hand, you've got something like BHP, which through the course of this cycle has increased fivefold, and you'd say, well, okay, well, that's a pretty impressive performance. And I know these are extreme examples. On the other hand, you've got something like Fortescue, which I couldn't even fit together on the same chart as BHP, because notwithstanding the fivefold rise in BHP, Fortescue has gone up 100 times what BHP went up. So there's a lot of activity there in the background, even though we might talk in general terms about commodities and equities. Now let's look at some pictures of the information that we've got in our research paper. The first picture is simply the chart of the commodity price series going back to, in this case, to 1900 that we've derived from the data sources that we've identified in the paper. Look at that in a slightly different way on a log scale. Shows you a slightly different set of or a slightly different perspective on it, and then we can just look at some of the key statistics. From point to point, from beginning to end, that series reflects a compound rate of growth of 2.3% per annum. Since 1960, the growth rate is 4.4%. Since 1980, the growth is 3.1%. Simple arithmetic, rolling 12-month return, 3.9%. Median was 0.3%. There's some positive skewness to the series, indicating a relatively long tail of high returns. There's some evidence of greater volatility after 1980, with an increase in the standard deviation from the 19% to the 23%. So that gives you some sort of broad picture of commodity prices in terms of some of the statistics. If we look at the equity price series, this is how that looks in terms of raw data going back to the 1930s. In this case, it is more meaningful to look at it on a log scale, simply because of the magnitude of the increase over that period of time. The point-to-point rise is 9.5% per annum from beginning to end. Since 1960, we've averaged a 10% per annum rate of increase. Since 1980, the average is 9.3%. The arithmetic, which is interesting because no matter how you segment it, the returns have been pretty much the same. The arithmetic average of the rolling 12 months is 12.5%. Slight increase in the standard deviation, 29% to 30%, not a significant difference really. I find that, one statistic interesting, that on a monthly basis, the average number of price rises is 55.1%, so a rolling return basis. 55.1% of the time on our analysis, we had positive returns on a monthly basis. If we divide that up and look at the period since 1960, it's 55.4%. The period since 1980, it's 54.8%. In other words, not much difference in variation. Around 55% of the time, we've had these increases. Now, I don't want to take you through too many statistics, but that's really the picture, if you like, in visual terms, that goes with all the data in the paper, just showing you the peaks and peaks and troughs. We're dealing with 12 price peaks, 12 commodity price peaks over that period of time that we're talking about, the 110 years or so. And on the equity price side, we're looking at 11 price peaks over a shorter period of time. We're looking at 11 price peaks over, and compared to the commodity series, over the same period of time, that is post-1936, we had 8 commodity price peaks. So, you know, a more volatile equity market than has been the case in the commodity market. Now, just looking at some of that in a little bit more detail. The average size commodity price peak. Now, I'm not quite sure what the average is worth, but we've gone through those 11 cycles and just looked at the average. The average duration of a cycle from peak to trough is 57 months. The time between peaks is 126 months, which suggests that this is a fairly long, drawn-out process. We're not talking about something that's going to happen over a period of 2 to 3 months and then we're back into what people regard as more normal circumstances. I guess the normal circumstance for these markets is one of being involved in some part of a cycle, and that these cycles are fairly long, drawn-out processes. Now, it seems to us that the commodity price peak or the commodity price cycle of which we are currently a part peaked about a year or so ago, around May 2007. That's the way we look at the cycle currently, which means that we're about somewhere around 15 months into a down cycle, which, as I said, on average goes about 57 months. Let's look at some variations in that. If we looked at, and you know, somebody said, okay, well, that's over 110 years, maybe times have changed, are these becoming more frequent? So I've just taken the last 5 cycles, basically since the mid-1970s, and to relook at those numbers, and they show that peak to trough, we're looking at something like 41 months, trough to peak, 64 months, peak to peak, around 99 months. So we're a little bit further into the process in terms of the modern cycle, but nonetheless, I think the message is still there that these cycles do tend to be fairly long and drawn out. The range is fairly wide, however, and what I've done in this diagram is just take the shortest possible times across to the various destinations. The shortest peak to trough we've had is 11 months. If that's the sort of cycle we're in at the moment, we're there at the bottom, if that's what we're in. I don't think we are, bearing in mind that coal and iron ore are still very much near the top of the cycle. There's still a lot of unfavourable macroeconomic circumstances ahead, so our guess would be that we've still got further to run. I think an important point in this context is, however, that the shorter the period from peak to trough, the longer, the more arduous grind of the trough is. So that even if, let's say, we do the first bit in 11 months, it still means we've got something like 60 months to wait to get to the peak next time. So a five-year wait. So as I say, the quicker the drop, the more arduous the adjustment process that subsequently has to occur before we make our way to the upper levels of the peak again. Okay. Having said all of that, we go one step further into this analysis, and we start bringing the two together and say, okay, what are the correlations in returns between the commodity prices and the equity prices? And what we've done here is between 1937 and 2007, just done a series of rolling correlations over 1 month, 3 month, 12 month, 36 month periods. Initially, to see, hey, you know, maybe there's some magic decision here. Maybe it's easy. But what we see over these periods, the returns correlations are quite low, sitting around 0.2, rounded. Not a good basis for taking an investment decision. So that's, I think, one of the first lessons. Having said that, it is possible that that might be too harsh a test to apply because it doesn't really take account of leverage. So, for example, if you had a rise or a fall in commodity prices, but equities moved disproportionately to the change in commodity prices, that would show up as a low correlation, just as a matter of the technicalities of the correlation. So as I say, that might be too harsh a test, but that leverage is important in investment markets. So we've looked at that in a different way and said, okay, let's just measure over that lengthy period of history, let's just measure the number of occasions on which the two moved in the same direction over 1 month, 3 month, 12 months and 36 month periods. And what we see here is what is consistent with our intuitive view that most of the time the two do move together. Having said that, however, it's pretty obvious that 40% of the time they do not. Now, I reckon that's a fairly important conclusion for somebody looking to tag a decision about equity investment to a view about commodity price movements. Because even if we sat here right now and resolved with absolute certainty that commodity prices were going to fall over any of those periods of time, what would we therefore do about equities? Well, you'd say, yeah, we'd take a corresponding view about equities, but there's a high degree of risk attaching to that. Now, let's burrow into this one step further, and we look at those circumstances where commodity prices fell, which in our view is a little bit more topical in the sense of where we are in the cycle currently. So when commodity prices fell over 1 month, 3 months, 12 months, we see that there is a potential for a break. So we're looking at periods when commodity prices fell and equities rose. 40, 50% of the circumstances, equities actually rose over those periods of time. And by the time you push out over a three-year period, the 36-month time horizon, again, if we said with absolute rock-solid certainty that we believe that commodity prices were going to be lower over that period of time, which is the sort of a period of time which we claim we're investing over as equity investors, if commodity prices are going to be lower in 36 months' time, what should our conclusion be about equities? Historically, they're going to be higher. So we can then start to look at what influences these results. And I suppose what we should focus on is really three sources of value drivers in resources, and to understand a little bit about why that disparity between commodity prices and equity prices occurs, we need to be conscious that we can really look at three value drivers: exploration success, which is really not important in the context of the larger companies, but really two distinctions: growth through new projects and higher or lower commodity prices, as the case may be. Now, we can see how important this might be, and I'll just use BHP Billiton as an example because it's sort of stereotypical of what's been happening. These numbers just show you the BHP Billiton profit change over the last 3 years. And what you see there is that their EBIT has gone from a bit under $10 billion to a bit over $24 billion over the last 3 years. At one level, a very creditable performance. And I should say, nothing that I say in this context is meant to disparage BHP in any way or to say that it's a bad investment. But it's about identifying what it is we're buying when we're buying a resource company. Because notwithstanding that significant increase in profitability, we look at the price impact, the impact of higher commodity prices, and we see that there's been an $18 billion contribution from commodity prices. In other words, the price rises were worth 1.3 times the earnings increase. This is very much a commodity price driven investment. Now, to draw the distinction between what we call a phase three company, that is a BHP Billiton type company, and a phase two company, which is the sort of company that was what we refer to as a phase two company, which is a growth-oriented company, I'll just show you this historical analysis, which we undertook as part of, I suppose, a verification process in some ways for our investment decision-making processes. This is based off, this chart's based off data over the period 1998 to 2002. Each of the green markers on the chart shows you a stock, and it's a stock which accords with our definition of phase two growth-oriented company. The yellow marker there shows commodity prices over that 1998-2002 period. This is a period some people would argue was the very worst of circumstances for the resources sector. And what it shows you is that over this period of time, there were some very significant investment returns from these companies delivering growth. The companies that were commodity price oriented did not perform that well, but those companies that were delivering growth, these phase two companies, did deliver the investment returns. This was the period when BHP was trading at $8 to $12 in that sort of range, while these sorts of quite outstanding investment returns were being made. So that goes some way to explaining why we get that disconnect between commodity prices on the one hand and equity values on the other. It's because we've got companies doing things, building value that's reflected in share prices. Now, if we summarise something of where we are in terms of our current commodity exposure, we think probably we're in a cyclical downswing at the current time. Might be wrong, but probably. If that is the case, equity prices will mostly follow commodity prices as they have been. But, again, to emphasise the important conclusion in this context, there is a significant, let's call it about a 40% chance that they will not. And that as we go further ahead over our investment time horizon, there is a loosening relationship between commodity prices and equity values. And in other words, there is a risk of tying the equity investment decision to a commodity price view. There are also timing differences, and I've used the iron ore and nickel example, which suggest also, and I'm not dwelling on this, but this is a side issue, a need for commodity diversification, price diversification in your portfolio construction decisions. Now, just to round off and meet our time commitments here, what does all of this mean for portfolio construction purposes? Well, I think we can look at many arguments in favour of maintaining exposure in the resources sector, and you know, and I haven't gone through any of those to a significant degree. People will talk to you about global economic growth. They'll talk about market contribution to the Australian stock market. They'll talk about China and the rest of Asia. What I've tried to emphasise here is one reason alone for maintaining a resource sector exposure, and that is management of the risk. That is the risk of missing out on the equity performance during the course of even a negative commodity price cycle. So that's the first implication for portfolio construction. The second implication is the need to look for strong organic growth profiles. To my mind, at any time, but particularly at this time in the cycle, things that are going to be worth more in a year's time, 2 years' time, 3 years' time, without a reliance on commodity prices. We're seeking to minimise commodity price earning sensitivity. We believe that at this point in the cycle, of all times in the cycle, you want to minimise that exposure and, as I say, focus on growth. In doing that, we want to find low-cost operations. We ask ourselves the question, can this investment survive the trough of a cycle? It mightn't happen. There might not be a trough, but we need to put everything through that stress test. If we're wrong and conditions are more favourable, then we'll get the investment returns. As an equity investor, that's a key test. We also want to find long life operations. Can it last more than one cycle? Or is it going to spend all its life in the trough of a cycle? Very important for value creation. And also, we're trying to ensure, or as far as we can judge, the execution ability of the people involved. Can the people develop the assets that they've got before them? We're also trying to assess access to capital. Is it a bankable project? Now, that in some sense reflects some of those earlier factors. So what we're trying to round out here is, given that view of commodity prices, given the connect or lack of connect between commodity prices and equity values, how do you go about constructing a resources equity portfolio? And this, to our mind, is the checklist of items that we ought to be going through in selecting our stocks. Last of all, in many respects, is the commodity price exposure. It's not irrelevant, but as I said, it's not front and foremost in our minds. We think that the portfolio construction process should focus on where the value is being built, not on where the value might come and go. And that's really, and I think I've done that in just on 25 minutes. That's really where we, our view of the resources world.
John, thank you so much. What a first-class presentation, I have to say. Very clear, very authoritative. I suspect your afterlife is university teaching or something like that. So we shall find out. There's more money in funds management, by the way.
I was just about to question that.
Okay, speaking of which, Caitlin Ruddock from Van Eyck will commence the question time. Caitlin has a doctorate and coincidentally has also spoken, as I believe, teaching at the University of New South Wales. So, yep. This is where you prove it's not a medical doctorate. We're over to you.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure the audience is going to have lots of juicy questions about, you know, small cap versus large cap resources, etc. So I thought I'd go back to a bit of a technical question on the paper. And do you think your results would hold if you had the data and you could partition by commodity price, so gold prices versus gold, a basket of gold stocks, and that you would see that, yeah, the same sort of price
specifically gold?
Yeah, if you could partition your study by commodities, do you think you'd see the same relationship? Because you've got sort of a basket of commodities.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
None of
the conclusions would differ. And the reason I say this is that when I first started looking at this sort of type of analysis. We started doing it with a range of individual commodities, and really the first sort of large-scale project we did on this was copper, and then we sort of replicated with a range of other commodities as best we could, really just to verify. You know, I mean, it's all very well sort of having the general conclusion and then having it fall down in every specific set of circumstance. So you want to try and avoid that. So yeah, so I'm happy personally. That it can be replicated across the other commodities. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying every commodity under every circumstance, but in a general sense, yeah. Okay. In each case, when I've referred to commodities, I've intended to refer to the commodity price series that we've described in the research paper, which is made up of primarily non-ferrous metals. That's you know in broad that so that's copper, nickel, zinc, lead, tin. And in the IMF's index, it would include iron ore. Right? So whenever I've referred to commodities, I referred to that basket of commodities. Whenever I've referred to equities, I was referring to the price indicators that are based off the ASX, which started off with the or mining index going back to the 1930s, which was then supplanted by the oil resources index, which started, I think, around 1978, and which was then supplanted by the S&P ASX, ASX 200 resources component, which started 2002. Right. So, and so the correlations that we're measuring are between that equity those equity indexes on the one hand and the commodity price indexes on the other.
Great. Let's open up to the room and have a second question. Got one in the back there.
Do you also look at coal? I know it's energy, but it's something we dig out of the ground.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We do. I guess, you know, what we're trying to do here, I mean, there's obviously, you know, some vast generalisations in this. And yes, we do, you know, we do have quite a degree of expertise in coal. In fact, Don Barnett, who's a professor of mineral economics at Macquarie University and recognised around the world as an expert in the coal industry, is a member of our advisory panel. So he helps us a good deal in that. And I just, in that context, I mentioned too, Phil Seckham, who's a professor of ore deposit geology out of Newcastle University, and we've got a senior consulting metallurgist with a long history of experience internationally, as well as Colin Jackson, who's a senior corporate director in Australia. They're members of our investment team in broad. So we do look at all the extracted commodities, including oil and gas, in terms of our analytical effort. We have access to mining engineers, and I think there's a sort of a network of people that we call on. So what we do, I mean, you know, this isn't necessarily about our process. We were going to touch on that in a moment, but we have a group of three fund managers, Tony, myself, Doug Goodall, and we have experience in institutional funds management as well as investment strategy in the sector. All of us, one way or another, have had a prior involvement in the resources industry. And then we have our advisory group, and that's a group of people who provide us with some really specialised, high-quality skills in terms of the technical analysis which needs to go into looking at the companies that we look at. And we're going to touch on it in a moment anyway, but every company we invest in, we have a very detailed financial model associated with a valuation process. And we draw on the metallurgists, the mine development people, the geologists that we have access to provide the technical inputs into that financial modelling process, which is an absolutely critical part of our overall investment process. Yes. Yes. Well, the paper that I refer to, the one written by Gorton, actually covers the full range and almost as a subset, but nonetheless an important subset, looked at the metal commodities, and that paper concluded across that full commodity range that same conclusion that I relayed to you. That is the breakdown between the relationship between the commodity producer and the commodity price movement. So that conclusion was generalizable across soft and hard commodities. Yes. You're dead on. If Graham Richard give me another hour or two, I'll take you through my full repertoire of presentation. And one of the charts that I frequently use is to illustrate the connection between those commodity price cycles and the global liquidity movements. And there's not a doubt in my mind of the connection between the two. And people often ask me about China and India and whatever, and I say, if I was sitting back in the 1980s with the econometric model that I developed at that time, didn't know anything about the future of China, and all I knew that global interest rates were going to be at historically lows in the early 2000s, what would I have predicted about commodity prices? And I would have predicted that they were going to be at record highs. And I think a lot of the future movement will be tagged to what happens to global interest rates, or the flip side of that, which is global liquidity movements basically generated by the US Federal Reserve, European Central Bank, and Japanese Central Banks.
There's been no significant change. In fact, I've said to all the advisors in recent times where we've been talking to that I'm not really seeing anything different to any other cycle. And that's why we haven't really gone out of our way to promote China or the view that this one's different and it's going to pan out differently. It looks like a bog standard cycle to me. Phase two companies, key definition of phase two company for us and the way we invest. It's a company that by definition has come out of phase one. That is, it's proven it's got something in the ground. So ticked off on that. It needs to have a development plan in place to exploit the resource. It needs to have the skill base in place to do the job. It needs to have the technology available. It needs to have access to capital, typically over a, for us, 3 to 5 year development horizon. That's our definition of phase two. There are over 800 things called resource stocks listed on the ASX right now. On our judgment, there's something like 170, 175 which fall into that phase two category.
Uh,
there are limitations there, but we've, notwithstanding all the genuine concern, the talk about port restraints and indeed all sorts of infrastructure restraints everywhere, we've done a remarkably good job in delivering new supplies. And you know, again, another chart that I typically use when I'm doing presentations is a chart of global copper mine output. And you know, in 1980, we were generating about 8 million tonnes a year of copper. Today, we're generating about 16 million tonnes, so double what was there. So the question is not, you know, has the supply increased by a large amount? I guess the question is the supply adequate for the needs? And there's no question that that connection is now fairly fairly tight. Having said that, it doesn't take much of a tweak to global growth for us to have a deceleration in the growth rate of raw material consumption. And that feeds into inventories, well, almost by definition, immediately. And then the key judgment is, on the supply side, you know, is there what's the speed of reaction to that? And that's typical in any cycle. Now, past cycles, we've had the industry going full belt in production. We've had a recession or a sharp slowdown in growth, a sharp slowdown in raw material consumption, and a sharp build-up in inventories. And that's caused a very large price fall very quickly. And that's your cycle. That's your definition of a cycle. There's an argument now that the inventory build-up won't be as rapid as it is in the past. But the fact is that the price drop occurs in response to the very earliest build-up in inventories. So most of the price fall occurs with the very earliest stage of the inventory build. And then the rest of the time you spend just trying to wear off that inventory build. I don't see anything different this time in that happening. And it's quite possible that even a small slowdown in China will lead to an inventory build in the short term. Yeah, I think you're certainly right, but we also come back to that question we had about liquidity. You know, the inventory build sets the direction. In my mind, the way I look at it, the inventory build sets the direction. So if copper prices are $4 a pound, the inventory start to build, the price will fall. Then we ask ourselves the question: well, where do prices come to reside after they've fallen? Two factors are relevant. One is the cost structure of the industry. That's a relevant factor. And the second factor is, as I said, that liquidity flows. And in that sense, it's another aspect of the government reaction. If governments keep interest rates low, they're injecting large quantities of liquidity into the global economy. That sloshes around the system and finds a home in various places, from real estate to art to commodities. So, yeah, you do have to. And I guess one of the points I was making in this, there are a hell of a lot of generalisations in what I had to say there. It is more nuanced than I was making out, but I was trying to draw out some of the broader themes. There's no question that whatever the source, if there's going to be a relaxation of the supply tensions in the industry, we potentially have lower prices. And by that I mean, you know, right now there's a risk premium factored into that market, that, you know, based on the concerns about the availability of supplies, whether it's copper or lead or coal or iron or whatever. And again, whether it's Europe or the US or China, a reduction in the momentum of growth, to my mind, will lead to a reduction in the consumption of raw materials, which potentially leads to some easing of that risk premium, which is another way of saying there's potential for a price fall. So that's the sequence that I see. Having said that, we should keep coming back to the notion that we are not investors in commodities, but we are investors in equities. So you're still left with the question of, even if I believe that that's the case, what do I do with my equity investment? And then we come back to this idea that there is this breakdown, and that the equities, that there will continue to be equities, continue to be companies that are building things that are worth more, and that, that's what we're looking for as equity investors.
Okay, timing-wise, I'm just conscious of the fact we're going to have to do our wind-up and we're going to have a quick commentary. Tony's kindly said he'll skip the run-through, so if we can take two more questions, then I'll have to...
I wouldn't mind a chance just to take one
more question, I guess one of the things here is it's time for another session. Paragem will put one on and you can come and talk. Okay.
That's right, Wes. Infrastructure. We've done a lot of this work, and the way I've looked at it in the past is looking at the what I call the investment intensity of GDP spend. So how much of the GDP is made up of investment spending, both private and government, and the connection between that and raw material demand. And there's no question that there is a very strong connect between investment spending for any given level of spending, and the level of raw material consumption, therefore the level of inventories, therefore the prices. That's certainly right.
John, do a quick two-minute finish.
Yeah.
And then we'll do the see whether everyone believes you by saying you're good, bad or indifferent.
What we wanted to do, and we've sort of touched on it, and I'll hurl through this very quickly, is just to talk a little bit about our process. We start off with, as I said before, over 800 things called resources stocks. We then focus in on 170 of those phase two companies, the emerging producers, the companies building things. We then take that down to a 50 stock focus list, which is really the group that we work on intensively. Every one of those stocks has a value, has a model attached to it. We tag a value to it, a dollar price tag, and then from that group of 50, we select 20 stocks, and that's our portfolio. We run with a 20 stock portfolio, no market capitalization constraint. It's all about bottom up stock picking, value generating process, subject to one constraint only, and that is at any one point in time we ensure a diversified commodity price exposure to avoid the commodity price bet. We have two products. We have a managed investment scheme called the Emerging Resources Company Share Fund, which is on a range of platforms and the like. But we also run the same investment process in individually managed account format. And for I won't go into the reasons why you might want to choose that, but we do have that as an option. There is one thing which I think is very important, which I did want to touch on, and that is the idea, because we're running with companies which may be on the small side, there's a tendency to say, wait a minute, aren't these very volatile? Might you just not end up with a volatile portfolio of volatile stocks? And I know you're looking at your watch, but what I've done there in the red triangles basically show you in that risk return format what our stocks look like out of our portfolio, and the blue markers are half a dozen of the market leaders. Right? And that's what you might expect intuitively. What we have been able to achieve through the investment process and the portfolio management process that we adopt, we have been able to achieve a return which is superior to the ASX 300 resources, for example, which is good, but we have been able to do that without any significant increase in volatility. And, we're always looking for our unique selling proposition, and we believe that that's it, because what we're essentially trying to do here is synthesize a diversified resource company with growth. That's what we're, and that's the outcome we've been able to achieve.
Good.
I'm done.
Well done. Did I mention to you that if you run over time, you can't get full marks?
No, you didn't.
Okay. In that case, we won't apply that. Gizmos out, if you would. SIM cards in. Ready to press 1, 2, 3, or 4. Based on the questions, I hope it's not a 1. Start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. All done. Thank you for that. If we could just, before you go, you're going to hear from Caitlin once again on where she thinks it all fits from a researcher's point of view.
Well, maybe I'll just, I thought it was a very interesting paper, and particularly I think it highlights some of the specialist skills resource analysts need to have. It's not just about predicting commodity prices, but, you know, obviously looking at what's in the ground, how companies manage that sort of development phase, etc. So I think that it just highlights you need specialist skills, whether it be at a generalist fund manager or a specialist fund manager. Globally at Van Eyck, we do a review, and obviously think that if you are going to invest with specialist global resources equity managers, you need to consider that allocation, take that allocation out of either your Australian small cap or your global equities, and also then consider how it blends with the managers you have. So obviously if you've got an allocation to a mining specialist, you're probably going to want to blend that with someone who's got a bit more of an industrial focus, etc. So.
Thanks, Caitlin. We're on time. Thank you so much. I hope you agree it's been a fabulous session. And those who want to come back can do this afternoon. Well done.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
So I was going to say
hats for my MP.
Oh, yeah?
Loved it. Actually, I'm doing my Oz Equities resource review later on the year. I'd love to get yourself and Tony in if that's possible.
Oh, shoot, yeah. Yeah, no, delighted, yeah. Actually, I'm a bit... Hang on. I'm a bit...